recent book authors are done at the College of Physicians soon. I forget when exactly, but coming soon. There's a, we sent out something about them too. They're fun to hear. I have met them both. I think if you're going to hear Offutt here next week, you're, I mean, over 2 weeks, you probably don't have to run to the college, but it's, you know, it's fine if you do want to. Seth Nukin wrote this, another book that is sort of tracking the, how did the safety of vaccines come into question so prominently and publicly. Offutt's book is a little more who's to blame for promoting the view that vaccines aren't safe. Nukin's book is a little more why are so many people convinced that vaccines aren't safe? If you will, he's trying to ask the question, what's so saleable about the vaccine danger hypothesis? Why do people buy into that and so much? So they do have slightly different takes on in the books and in their presentations. Reminder too, the books, Hila has them. Anybody come by to take them? So they're there. If you want to take a look, you can borrow them. Any questions come up from the readings this week? Just straight up before we get into the sort of issues. Anybody tell me how what makes HPV vaccine different from, let's say, measles vaccine?
I actually have a question. Okay. I think it was actually from last week's reading, but one of the articles mentioned that randomization in a trial would reduce autonomy or would take away from autonomy. Why is that? Or just that people don't have a choice about what they're doing? Or?
Yeah. So people normally want to choose between the standard of care and the new thing. Okay. Randomizing it and blinding it means that you tell them half of you aren't going to get anything. And some people think that is just unethical even as an offer. You always ought to be able to at least know that whichever group you go to, when you consent, you're going to get something one way or the other. I'm not sure that objection is valid. I mean, if you really don't know that the new thing is any good and you're just testing it, it's not like you're missing out if you don't get it. And there may be situations where there is no standard. So you're just randomizing against, you know, we don't know what to do about X, but we have a new vaccine. So randomization against, in situations where there aren't any, anything even minimally therapeutic is certainly, I think, not obviously unethical. Randomizing against the standard of care may make people feel better because they feel like they're going to get something either way, but it's that belief that something's better than nothing. That isn't always true. You could certainly wind up in the active arm of a randomized trial and be made sick. It's happened, not frequently, but it's happened, and not infrequently. So there's always risk in getting a new agent. But people tend to hear, I'm going to get nothing or something. And I don't like that. I'd rather have the choice of something versus something. I think that's what they're pushing.
My question with the autonomy was that, I mean, if it's voluntary and consent, I mean, doesn't consent trump, I mean, the issue of autonomy and randomization?
Well, you'd say something like, the value here is I want people to choose, but if I withhold, if I didn't give them the option of active agent versus new thing, and I just got them to consent to active agent versus nothing, then I tricked them. Because there is, there may be a standard and they should have the right to pick it if they want to do that. And that's that tension again. The FDA policy has always been, if you run drugs or vaccines against placebos, you'll get a faster answer and fewer people exposed because you can see pretty quickly whether something's good or bad. If you run a new thing against the existing standard, depending on how effective the standard therapy is, it's going to take you a lot of subjects and a lot longer to get an answer because you're masking benefits because the difference between the new thing and the thing that's partially effective may not be that big. So you got to run a lot longer, more expensive, get a faster answer is the right way to go. So you're asking the subjects, in a way to make a sacrifice for the common good when you run against placebo, because you're saying maybe we'll get an answer quicker as opposed to giving it to standard therapy.
But how is that the common good if the purpose of the trial would be to figure out what new treatment I want to do? Do I want to do the new treatment or do I want to do the old treatment?
Because we're doing research and this is not intended to give you the therapeutic choice, I'm just speaking FDA here, you are going to be able to get involved in research, we're going to give you this for free, we're going to monitor you closely, but it's research. So
but you're not helping.
What you need to know, we'll get an answer generally.
Well, I'm saying, I don't, as a doctor, I don't care what it does versus placebo, I care what it does versus the other drug that I'm currently prescribing.
Right, and that would be a good therapeutic attitude, but it's not the right research attitude. What I want to know is the new thing good? And the fastest answer to that is for me to stick you in a placebo trial, even though it may mean you're not going to get the standard of care. Now, here's the real reality. If I don't give you the stand, if I give you the new thing, particularly in vaccines versus placebo, your standard of care anyway is nothing because you don't have any vaccine here. Now, it would be true if I tried to run it in a more, in a richer country, I'd have probably, people would be screaming at me to give you the standard of care, but you don't have it here. So, did I violate anything? You're not worse off than you'd be tomorrow morning with nothing, so why isn't it right to get the faster answer, I'm asking you.
Well, if we're talking about developing countries, but if we're talking about developed countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk developing. You like exploiting them better?
Oh no, I'm saying I was talking in the context of doing this in America. I didn't really
Well America's got them. They don't sign up for anything. I think only 3% of people with breast cancer are in a clinical trial, so it's hard to recruit them because they're always being told, oh, you know, the therapy here is good, the therapy there is good. They're not likely to sign up at the same percentages because there are standards of care for them. I mean, you'll get them, if you have the bizarro brain tumor, you'll probably get people signing up. But generally speaking, it's hard to recruit them. They don't want to go into placebo trials, much less any trials. And they're probably having a fight, those of you who know oncology, between their community oncologist and the university oncologist. University oncologist saying, I think you should try the new thing. The standard stuff isn't that good. And the community guy saying, I'd never go near that new thing. It's going to make you sick. Use the standard thing. That's what I know. We know, well, it's only 20% effective, but you don't want to forego that. That's the battle there. But what is wrong with saying to the poor schnook in a poor nation, you got nothing. At least I'm going to give you something. I'm making you better off. I'm not dragging in the medicine chest from, you know, Wayne, Pennsylvania to give you, but that wasn't here to begin with anyway. So why am I exploiting you? Why did you use that word, Art, or critic? I mean, what's exploitative about it? Is it exploitative? Anyway, you don't have to answer that one today, but you better be ready to answer by the time we get around to the trials overseas, because that's the nub of the ethics challenge. Am I, if you don't have anything, and I give you something, are they doing, isn't that better than if you complain to me and say we got to replicate what is considered standard of care in the developed world in order to run a trial against that, which would be hugely expensive to do, and maybe not doable. I mean, in the real world, just may not be able to duplicate that in a very poor, poor place. We love poor places too, precisely because, from a science point of view, the people haven't been exposed to standard of care, so they're much more naive subjects, much more likely not to give us any complicated results to interpret because they've been on other drugs or been through the standard of care. So they're looking attractive all of a sudden because they're sort of diseased and untreated. They're also cheap, plus expensive to run around there.
Don't most protocols now have a fail-safe where if you don't respond and you're in the placebo group and the experimental agent shows effectiveness that they'll put you into the other, but they'll give you the, they'll kick you out and give you the...
That's called a crossover design. Yeah. And some do, some don't. Again, in a poor country, if you got bad results, in honesty, you'd be shutting down. I mean, no one's going to chase that. But the issue then becomes, how bad do the results have to be before we shut this down? So if you have a board made up of biostatistics people, drawn from, you know, Harvard, Penn, and UCSF, then they're gonna say, when we get to 0.01 significance, we'll shut this trial down because there's enough adverse events. If you had a board made up of mothers and fathers from a particular group in Malawi, they might say, when you get to about 0.3 significance, shut this down. I mean, we don't wanna be exposed to that kind of risk. That's, so what I'm saying is, if you follow standards of evidence required to get published in American or British medical publications, you're gonna run those trials in the face of adverse events until you're really sure those adverse events are linked up to this intervention. If you're just a subject, even an American subject, you may be thinking, gee, I don't wanna be exposed to risk like that. Even if you're uncertain that it's really caused by the agent, shut it down. So it's whose values dominate as to whether they get to a crossover or a closure. On the benefit side, it's the same challenge. So somebody may be saying, we're all dying here of dengue fever and you have a new vaccine. As soon as anything looks good, please deliver it. Versus, that just isn't good enough. No one's gonna believe us if we stop this trial until we get to a reasonable level of statistical significance. Reasonable being defined as what statisticians think is reasonable. I mean, it's not some gold standard written on tablets brought around by Moses. It's just some group of, it's actually historical standards. You know, we all kind of agree that's good enough. 1 in 20 risk that it's just random, or 1 in 100 that it's just random. So there's a lot of, I don't like to say this publicly, but you know, statistics is normal. Just is. You can't get away from it. Looks scientific, looks all fact, but it's normative. You can see judgments getting made all the time about how much prior evidence is enough, how much of this evidence is enough, what are the stakes? The stakes determine whether you're gonna stop earlier, if, you know, if you're running some trial about psoriasis and you're getting adverse events, you're probably gonna shut it down a little faster than if you're running a trial on the dengue fever vaccine, where you might say, this is pretty high stakes, we gotta get there. They're dying in droves. So, you know, there's a strong normative element that is never, well, I shouldn't say, is rarely acknowledged in statistical stuff. So what I was gonna ask you, any other questions, is somebody tell me what's different about the HPV vaccine than the measles vaccine. Why am I dealing with something different?
The sexual nature of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge yuck factor. And it, you know, kind of tends to pollute the discourse.
I mean, no, I think that's true.
It has a emotional valence that might not be there with other types of vaccine.
Absolutely. What about the literal making of the vaccine, or how it's composed, how you make one?
Well, I was just gonna say, it's MMR is like a live attenuated as opposed to HPV, which is, I think it's capsid particles, like
subunit vaccine.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the vaccines that is built from knowledge of the genome of the virus. Unlike a lot of vaccines, which are built out of either killed viruses or severely attenuated viruses, meaning weakened, which means I culture them in dishes long enough so they don't seem to be nasty. Although every once in a while, one reverts back to the nasty stage. That's how you might get polio from a attenuated virus polio vaccine. But you're trying to make the virus elicit a response without getting the disease. So sometimes killed virus will do it. Sometimes you need to have attenuated virus. Occasionally, with bacteria, the external coating will do it. You don't have to give the whole bacteria. And every once in a while, these days, you get to realize that a genetic message, which makes a protein, just a part of the protein that the virus normally makes, will get the vaccine, elicit an immune response. And that's the capsid idea. So if I have the right DNA bit, and I can make some RNA, and then it can make a little bit of protein, not the whole virus replicating, but just a little piece of it, so to speak, a subunit, I might get an immune response. What's the good news? Why is that desirable? There are a couple of reasons why it's desirable. But
it limits side effects, and you can't get the disease from it.
Can't get the disease from it, so that's a major safety issue. Much safer to use subunit vaccines than to use attenuated or killed. They may not be quite killed or they may not be quite attenuated, so, but you can't get the disease, that's major. What else? How do we make those stupid attenuated viral vaccines? What do we have to do?
To culture them in like tissue or egg, or it's like a process. It takes a lot of time and you have to apply
exactly.
through a lot of different cell cultures.
So you are waiting literally for eggs to get laid and you're trying to hope that whatever the virus is you want to grow will grow on the egg. There was shortage of H1N1 swine flu vaccine because it didn't grow well on eggs. It just didn't flourish. It said it didn't grow at all, but it didn't grow fast. So you're kind of waiting around. Then you got to scoop it out of the egg. Then you got another problem. You got to make sure that when you take it out of the eggs, it didn't get polluted with something else, some other piggyback microbial entity, which leads you to be interested in things like mercury and other adjuvants to try and make the vaccine sterile. You don't have any of this problem with the subunit approach. You can actually put it in a bag of stuff that is like going to turn into protein, put it in the right media, and you make a ton of stuff like overnight. It's sort of like, oh, here's a little genetic message. It says turn this goop into proteins and it will do it very quickly. So you could actually produce far more quickly, far more cleanly, far more safely this style of vaccine. So the future is probably headed toward this type of vaccine construction. And it's important to realize, I think, what was it, the Hep B thing is made this way. There's HSV, the herpes simplex, has a vaccine that's kind of rattling around that also looks like a subunit production thing. So we may see more of these. They're not the same safety worries as you normally have with vaccines, so we'll have to see what the anti-vaccine community does. We may hear a little about it today when confronted with an HPV vaccine as opposed to a flu vaccine.
So if it's faster and cheaper, why is it so expensive?
Well, in all honesty, what you're really doing in the first round of, say, HPV vaccine is you're paying back all the work that got done to map the sequence of the different strains of HPV virus, of which they're trying to 100 plus something, identify which ones cause cancer, identify which ones cause genital warts, get the whole map done, and then put that into production. So I think companies would say, both startups and big ones, we have to recoup the genomic research investment, and it's a little higher perhaps on HPV because we may even build into the cost developing a next generation vaccine. Now, if you want to believe that, Malark, no. But I mean, I think that's, the argument goes something like, we had to put in a pretty big investment up front. It's not that they had to build a new factory, they didn't, they just had to build a couple of incubators to pour the goop into so it makes the proteins. But I think there's an expensive genomic research history behind it. I think that's what's going on there.
There's also a QIAGEN kit that identifies the B7B6 and L1 antigens. It's about $100.
Just for
the kit.
So those marker things, they're expensive. Now, once you start to learn to do this, and also the cost of mapping genes in us or in viruses and bacteria comes down, you may see price decreases. You know, this is, some of it is the, you're gonna run sequences through these big analyzers, the kind that Illumina makes and other companies, and they've been looking to get down to the $1,000 genome in humans, but there is a kind of 10 buck genome in microbes. But when they started this a while back, it was pretty expensive to run the DNA and all the viral strains and get it all straight. Pricing also, what I've seen over the years is you may also take into account, well, what are people paying right now to treat the disease? So if you're getting pap smears, and there's a certain percentage of people that have to go through surgery, you might say, well, if I priced it here, I'm still under what it costs now to treat cervical cancer, so I can save you money, and I do keep an eye on what the standard of care is costing. I can tell you, I don't know why I should tell you, but I can tell you that years ago, I got this weird call from Pfizer about Viagra, and they asked me if I would be a consultant. And there's some good jokes here about why would they pick me up and consult them on that drug, but I'll let them all go and simply say they did. So I said, I'm interested in that, but I want to be able to see everything, go to everything. I don't want you guys cutting me out of meetings. I want to see what goes on. And they said, well, okay. The reason being, they knew that the drug was going to be very successful. They didn't have much to hide. They were kind of sitting on top of a very successful drug. Without going on and on about it, the way they priced it was, they said, well, what does sexual dysfunction cost to treat now, and then we'll price under that. There wasn't a research recoup cost thing, because it turned out they were running this drug as a anti-blood pressure medication. They hadn't spent much money on it. There wasn't really that much to pull back, but what they did was they priced the market and then went lower. It wasn't that they did it the same, but it was kind of asking, what's the market going to bear? We have something where you don't have to use a injection or a pump or things that people don't like. It's just a pill. And they're already spending X amount per year to get this treatment. So that's another pricing strategy, is to recover the cost simply by looking at what the market is currently holding. So I've heard both the HPV story is sort of a recouping of investment in HPV circles. The other drugs and vaccines get priced a little bit according to what you're spending on it now, and can we come under that?
Do the cervical cancer screening recommendations change if someone's had the HPV vaccine?
Well,
I mean, I understand that you can make the argument for the cost of treating the cancer, but
you still need your pap smears, right?
Right.
And there still are going to be cases of cervical cancer, though hopefully if you bump out a certain percentage of people who are infected with the major strains of cancer-causing virus, you may reduce the number of surgeries that you need to do, and you may also reduce the number of repeat tests, because those of you know, pap smears sort of get a, ooh, maybe something's wrong, well, we'll retest it, and then sometimes they take a little biopsy and retest. So hopefully you'd cut some of those costs back, but that's where the savings is. It's not really on the recommendation that you stop getting a pap smear or something like that. There was we're not going to look at the fight today, but just in case any of you are interested, there are people who would say it's great to put HPV vaccine into poor India or Peru or places where it cervical cancer is a huge, huge problem. But there are others who would say it might be just as effective to put in some kind of cheap pap smear testing. And people have talked about that a little bit as to whether that works and how accurate that is. So the mere fact that you have a vaccine, a little bit like that fight that's breaking out, which we'll look at later, about eradication of polio, it doesn't always mean that the vaccine is, I mean, the vaccine's great, but it doesn't always mean it's the best, cheapest, on the ground thing. If you really had a little more infrastructure, maybe you'd move to a pap smear strategy that was cheap or crudely accurate and try to get after it surgically anyway. It may not be the most, it may still be burdensome for the women as opposed to the vaccination, but it could be really cheap if you could launch the right kind of screening. So that discussion is, it's rattling around as noise behind the HPV in developing world debates. You see that. So we all know how many viruses, what's the deal with cervical cancer? How many viruses cause that? Strains of virus, I mean?
Two of the main ones.
So there are two of them cause about 60%, and then there's another 7 that cause cervical cancer that are rarer here, although if you look at some of the numbers, and these are actually due to the pharmaceutical industry, they're not just private researchers, the distribution of the strains is not uniform. So two strains here, 60%. What two strains in Ethiopia are doing, less well known. I mean, whether it's the same two causing the same amount of cervical cancer, it's certainly a major cervical cancer problem, but it's not, it's pretty clear that in some parts of the world, the two strains that are bigger here are not as big. There are also two strains that cause warts. And then the rest seem, as far as people know, relatively harmless. Some of them cause little growths on your neck. They're sort of associated, sometimes flare up when you're pregnant or something. Some of them just seem to circulate around. Nobody knows. It would be fair to say, I don't know, harmless. Nobody knows what the hell they're doing. they're just there. There are a lot of viruses that move around and don't do anything to us that are kind of our little companions, but there are a number of these strains that seem to be that way.
Something I didn't see in any of the readings would be was the idea that once we, if we end up, you know, really dampening the effects of these two strains,
yeah.
won't other ones take their place, possibly?
Possibly. It's a real unknown, is the honest answer to that. But it's a good point, because if you reduce the incidence of some things, are others just going to occupy the empty niche or expand out, or are there biological differences in terms of who gets infected by what? I think a lot of you know there are some people who are HIV infected who don't seem to convert, at least in a serious way, to full-blown AIDS. So they clearly have some sort of biological resistance. In Africa, some of the strains are really virulent, like kill you very fast. Are there biological differences in the uptake of the virus? Does it grow better in certain genetic areas? Does it mode of transmission? You've got it intravenously as opposed to sexually, as opposed to, I don't know, whatever. So I don't know. It's one of those riddles of epidemiology. As far as I understand it, I don't think we know the answer to whether it would just expand out.
Yeah, I read a couple articles that I think play into the debate for not favoring the mandate.
Don't go there yet.
Okay,
hold that up.
All right.
I mean, I'm just trying to get some facts out before the class.
It seemed like it was really hard to distill the facts, which may have something to do with the fact that, like, perhaps we're still getting knowledge on this, because I read a lot of conflicting numbers about there are 100 different strains, there are 150 different strains.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Like, 30
yeah.
cancer causing.
The problem, you're on a problem that's real. We are still mapping a lot of the critters. And so how different they are, part of this is what may be lumped as the same strain could turn out to have very slight mutational differences that the current techniques don't pick up. So that's
okay.
True. Same is true, by the way, for HIV, which we know mutates fast and has a lot more strains than this one. But probably it's worse if we were getting very accurate at the mapping, we'd probably see even more subtle differences that could really build resistance or virulence or whatever. So yes, you're right about that. Let's see, any other little fact?
Just a question that would follow on that. Is it known that HPV mutates like HIV?
It doesn't. It's a much slower strain mutator. Those major ones have been around kind of in their form at least for 30 years. People sort of kind of know them. The question is, are there small mutational differences? Let's put it this way. Some people have the BRCA1 and 2 breast cancer marker, but some people get their breast cancer at 30 and some people get it at 70. Something is going on in the rest of the genome that's driving how aggressive it is, and that's what's not known about HPV. We know it causes cancer strains 1 to 9, but it explodes as cervical cancer in some women, and some women get cervical cancer, you know, when they're 75, and they're all lumped together now as this causes cervical cancer. So it's not clear what the smaller genetic differences are, or the differences in the recipients that either do or don't give them more immunity. Even if they're going to get cancer, it just doesn't, it may have to go through a couple of changes in cell alteration. I'm going bananas here with the biology thing that I want to get into, but you know, first you get to sort of a little cancerous, precancerous, ooh, that's really badly cancerous, ooh, that's cancer. And that sequence and how fast it happens, that's what we don't understand a lot about, or at least I don't, but I think I've been to enough lectures, I don't think the experts do either, about HPV. So we know they cause cancer, but we don't know fast, who's going to really get it quickly, who's going to get it slow. You know, you look at the BRCA1 data, the BRCA2, it says, well, it's a high association with breast cancer, but if everybody gets it over 80, it's sort of like, well, I mean, everything falls apart after 80. I don't know. What's the point here? So I think what we're really interested in is the earlier prevention. It's not that 80-year-olds are going to not want their breast cancer treatment, but you're when you talk genetic predisposition or viral predisposition, you're kind of interested in what's the early onset thing here rather than things that might just be associated with a diminished immune system in old age. Anything else?
I noticed in one of the articles that they were talking about the initial studies looking at the HPV vaccine demonstrated that it decreased the incidence of SYN 2 and 3, I think those precancerous lesions.
Yeah.
Has it actually been borne out? Like, do they have long-term enough data to demonstrate that it actually
doesn't
cause...
There's a way to collect it, but still not it.
Because a lot, I know a lot of times, like, even lesions like that will just kind of spontaneously remit.
Yeah.
And
go
so,
away
like,
anyway.
Right, so like in girls who are like 18 to 30, I think the recommendations are like, you may not even biopsy something. Like, you may not even biopsy something that looks atypical.
Understood.
So,
I don't think they have enough data from enough women with those early lesions that they've tracked out to see whether they just went away or developed into, don't know.
Uh-huh.
One other small fact about, which comes into our questions today, there are certainly HPV transmission routes that are not just straight sexual intercourse, so there may be some value in preventing oral cancers, and there may be some value in preventing anogenital cancers, even in male-to-male transmission. The data on that is only just now coming in a little bit, but there do seem to be a little bit of protective effects there too. So some of these cancer-causing things can get into the same mucous membrane-y environments and cause other sorts of cancer. I mean, they may not be other sorts of cancer, they just may be in different places. We think maybe the same thing, just in your mouth as opposed to in the reproductive organ. So. But there is data coming that way, and obviously the people who want to promote the vaccines are very excited to see it might have more of a protective effect than just the straight up cervical cancer prevention. The other thing I was going to tell you is one of the funniest things to read in the literature. We had an article on it this week, Sarah Hell and I, but it's just funny to watch, is the attempt to figure out what difference does genital warts make. Or if you know an economist or are married to one or have to talk to one ever, then you might say, in your great scheme of quality adjusted life years, what economists attempt to figure out, is this worth doing, intervention X, because it will give so many years of life per person that we treat and so many years of quality of life. How do you evaluate something like genital warts? So genital warts didn't kill anybody as far as I know. And from an economic point of view, it doesn't mean you don't work, and it doesn't mean that you're bedbound, and it doesn't mean you can't engage in activities of daily, you can comb your hair, feed yourself. But if you go out and ask particularly young people, do you like having a giant wart on your penis? So how to weigh the value of that and what it's worth to prevent it is really kind of an interesting challenge. I like it because it's tough to quantify. It's more of a values kind of problem that, I won't say it's impossible to quantify, but it's not so easy to quantify straight up. So that's an interesting challenge, because if you start to think about taking vaccine into the poorer nation, you've got your Glaxo vaccine that is effective against two strains. You got your Merck vaccine that's effective against four, quadrivalent and bivalent. And the Glaxo one is only effective against those two cancer causers, right? Well, let's turn this on its head. So if you're gonna decide as the government of Gambia, which one are you gonna buy?
The cheaper one.
The cheaper one. And what's Glaxo gonna do? I think they're gonna be cheaper because they got two instead of four. And then I think the argument is gonna be, do we care about genital warts among the Gambians? I mean, you know, you sort of like, well, if I can get more vaccine out that prevents cancer, as opposed to a more expensive vaccine that gives me the other broader benefit, which, if I'm Bill Gates, I want to buy a batch of this and send it to some place, which one do I want to buy?
What is the difference between the two vaccines?
Luck. I think the people at Glaxo just did not track down the two non-cancer-causing ones. That's the ones they mapped and focused on and stopped and made the vaccine.
I think they
decided not to go after it? Oh, it could be.
Yeah,
I don't know.
There's a big debate as to whether or not it was going to be useful.
Had the genital warts debate.
As a genital vaccine as opposed to a cancer vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
They chose the cancer vaccine sort of group. But they had the technology.
So they had identified the other two. Early on. So it could be a business proposition, it could be a we know we can get more of this made and cheaper, you know, if we just go the two route, or we don't care. But you might, you know, here's a, somebody could write a paper in here saying, you know, do or do we not care about genital warts in rural India? Do we or do we not? I don't know. I don't know. I have a hunch that, Glaxo's vaccine was adopted in the UK. Now, Glaxo's a big UK outfit company,
right?
And I don't know what the British think about genital warts, but I would have thought there might be some interest in having the, let's call it, better vaccine than the one they picked. So there's obviously some politics going on there, and I think they could afford, you know, to use the quadrivalent vaccine. And when Gates buys it, in the few instances in which they haven't bought a lot, but they bought a little, it's been the Glaxo one, I think, on price. And Glaxo is certainly sensitive to underpricing Merck on the vaccine front. They're certainly watching that. There's a little rhetoric that flies, which is kind of funny, which is, you know, we want to do right by the poor countries, so we're going to price this a little cheaper, but you're sort of saying, well, it came later to the market, and you only got a two thing, and you don't care about general warts in these countries anyway. So it's an interesting sort of ethics look-see. But again, next time somebody tells you everything is easily quantifiable, ask them about general warts. That's what I want to know. What are they doing about general warts? It's just like a giant headache. And a forerunner to many other quality of life issues that we're going to face in the health policy road. That's more to the point. It's not just a vaccine issue. It's sort of a, what's it worth to get rid of migraines? What's it worth to get rid of a, you know, gum disease? What's it, there's a lot of things that, or halitosis, or something, you know, there are a lot of things you might say, oh, socially I despise this, but it seems to me there's no effort being spared to try and develop something for baldness. We seem to have a pen, you know, round-the-clock laboring in dermatology on stem cell treatments for baldness. My friend George Gusteris is over there, you know, day and night trying to grow hair from stem cell follicles, and it's pretty clear there's a pretty big market for treating baldness. Pretty big. Might not score high on your quality scale, but I mean in terms of like real life saved and real disability prevented, but it's there. All right, enough rattling on about that. I think that lays out the land of HPV. So, and you, and who are my two, okay. Did you guys, did I have you up for this week? Not you.
No.
Two of them.
Yeah.
No. Who's your partner? He's crying here. Victoria. Okay. Were you two going to do the presentation from last week? Didn't I assign something to you? Didn't I,
yes,
in front of a publicly available group?
We didn't.
You didn't work together. You don't care about one another. That's all right. You didn't have to. That wasn't a requirement. I wanted to go first to somebody who's going to tell me why there should be a mandate for HPV in women, and then the second question, which is over here somewhere, who do I have doing this? You two. What about boys? Right?
Yeah.
You're staring at me like...
Roughly it was like pro and then con.
Yeah, that's right. Pro, I mean, did I ask you to do, should do boys?
It was like the question with mandate yes or no, and then sub-question, mandate for...
For boys.
Yes,
so you had the mandate for boys. Okay.
Was it mandate for boys or recommendation for boys?
Oh, I guess recommendation.
I don't think I said mandate. I just said, should we urge it in boys? It'd be hard to get a mandate on boys. But we could have a mandate for women, young women. Some places have talked about that, states in the U.S., maybe elsewhere. So what did you come up with in the readings, or what considerations? Go there.
I
didn't
do either.
No, do pro. Go to your pro. Yeah, go to your pro. I think the he-men of the class are supposed to do the no.
Okay, I'll just forget I have more. Okay, I'll just lay out some of the main arguments. Mostly in favor. I pulled some statistics from some other studies that I looked up. Okay, so I think that background speaks for favoring a NHPV vaccine mandate. HPV and the associated diseases that are manifest are causing growing concern. It's responsible, the HPV, the virus is responsible for 99.7% of cervical cancers, which is pretty close to 100%. HPV is also the most common STD in the United States, and has a huge economic burden, like we talked about. The treatments alone, numbers I found is that the median is about $418 million for the treatments, and that falls in the range of, I think, from $160 million to $1.6 billion for treating all the associated diseases. So it should really be a mandate for girls, because both males and females are carriers and are affected by targeting all women. The hope is that we will, in effect, create a herd immunity for both males and females. And we can't achieve the full benefit without herd immunity. The best way to get people to follow this is through a mandate. I don't know how much I should talk for.
When I get tired, I'll tell you.
Okay. All right. It really only is ethical to provide this vaccine because we have knowledge of it, because we have the resources to supply it.
The we is U.S.?
Yes. And it would have a huge benefit for both males and females. A study that I found that was released just on February 3rd in the New England Journal of Medicine was over 18 countries and 4,000 men aged 16 to 26. This is for when men were given the HPV vaccine, they were 90% less likely to develop genital warts, which I think speaks again to the need to protect both males and females, and again the idea that we can accomplish this by targeting the female population.
Okay, so it's Veronica, right?
Yeah.
Veronica Victoria, I like that. you want to add any other pro mandate?
Sure. So Veronica mentioned the severity of the risks of cervical cancer and the efficacy of this vaccine. So that just lays out the framework as to why an HPV vaccine is important, but in terms of why an HPV mandate is important, I think that it could ensure that young women whose parents are maybe not as informed about the necessity of this vaccine or aren't as motivated or have false information or a variety of other factors, it'll ensure that these young women will get this vaccine as if we do it as a high school entrance requirement. And a mandate is, according to some of the studies, the only proven way to ensure high rates of vaccination. So if we want to achieve herd immunity or even just immunity for these particular young women, this is the only proven way to ensure high rates by mandating it.
And so let me ask you, either of you, what do you mean by mandate?
So mandate is a word that is used, but I'm not sure if it actually means what it is defined to mean in the dictionary, in that typically it is more of an opt-out provision, where the school system will say that it's a requirement, but it's fairly easy for a parent to say that their daughter should not get the vaccine. But what I understand, it doesn't even need to be a religious or philosophical reason, it can just be any reason.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could argue for whatever you like.
That's the current. I don't want to push my luck. Really, I think
uh-huh.
it's too new,
uh-huh.
and to all of a sudden impose a mandate
uh-huh.
in the strict sense of the word, it's going to scare more people off and will do more damage to this cause than necessary.
Is that the
yeah.
flimsy, weak
Also, I mean, I do have a lot more arguments against the mandate, but I believe that the terms of the mandate would lie with the states, and along with that, any stipulations for opting out, I think, would lie with the states.
So just to capture this particular point, when we're talking about, in the U.S., mandates, we have strong mandates. You must do this to get benefit X or access to service Y. School entry is strictly enforced. You have to get immunized, or you can't come in here. No exceptions. A couple of states actually have that on the books, states you might not expect. Mississippi is one of them that I remember that has a very strong state law, no exemptions. I should say, there are some of those egg allergy things and stuff. It's a health thing. You get exempted. Outside of that, you don't get exempted. You could come for a somewhat weaker mandate, which says, yes, it is presumed you're going to do this, but we will allow you or your parents to opt out if they have objections. And you can make that easier or harder depending on how difficult you want to make it to get the objection. You could say, just sign a piece of paper and you're out. Or you could say, get it notarized. Or you could say, go to a judge and present your case. I mean, you could ratchet up the exemption side of this thing, saying we will let you out, but you're going to have to make a convincing case that you truly have a good belief reason. What Victoria was hinting at is that in some states, basically any mumbling of the word religious is going to take you out, and no one's going to ask you, and what religion was that, or what's your belief about it? It's just, I have a religious objection, is going to take you out, and you're not going to get pressed about it. In other situations, you might decide to make it something you could exempt out from, but it could be a harder path. You could really set some obstacles out and say, no, we're not going to let you out very easily. You have to get it to us. Now, you said early days. There is a notion that vaccines come through a kind of life cycle. That's in one of the articles that you had, where they kind of get approved, then they get rolled out, then people get used to the idea that they're around, then we watch them to see what adverse events might take place out in the world, real world of use, outside of clinical trials. And acceptance is sort of generated by familiarity. And that's a nice thesis, and I wrote it, signed my name to that paper too. I'm just not sure it's true. The opposition to measles vaccine is not diminished, or pertussis, because it's been around a long time, and if anything, it may have spiked up a little bit more in opposition. I'm not sure the vaccine life cycle idea, and if we wait, they'll accept it. But it may be true that early days, nobody's going to want it pushed upon them.
Along those lines, and also what we touched on earlier about the economics of the issue, the expense of the vaccine, the benefit of mandating as well is that this will help promote universal access, which is very important, which will help drive down the cost, and will also help make the vaccine available to a much broader spectrum of the population, and perhaps also portions of the population that may be more at risk, may need it more. That's another topic, I think, but I think the route to universal access and helping to bring down the cost of that vaccine is important consideration and understanding that would go along with it.
Can you give us some baseline as far as like when measles, mumps, rubella, varicella came online, as far as that data licensure versus when that went on a mandate or on a recommended list to understand, you know, was it zillions of years?
Pretty quickly together.
Exactly. So I think that's really important to understand, you know, what it's been like in the past for different vaccines and how quickly they were mandated versus.
I mean, we're talking, I don't remember date of approval to roll out of vaccination, but it was like 2 years. I mean, it wasn't 10 years.
Polio was extremely quick.
Yeah, probably 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So
they trended historically to be pretty close.
Right. So why should it be any different? It's just because it's
not passed in schools.
What's that?
Because it's not transmitted in schools, perhaps.
Well, chickenpox for sure, right? Or
I think this borderline between, like in-school transmission and public health gets a little fuzzy because, with HPV, we are talking about way more social issues.
Yeah.
You could say that kids socialize and get to know each other in schools, therefore, perhaps it is, in essence, transmitted in schools.
Mm. One of the things that just came out recently was that some of the hypotheses about transmission school of measles aren't quite as true. It seems to follow a better transmission route among friends of people. Yeah, sort of social connection, which would make it a little more HPV-like in some way or something. But it may not be quite as bad to get it in school as it is to have your friends come over to play with you and visit your house and do that sort of stuff. It was a study that just ran, I forget where, but within the past, I think we sent it out, past couple of weeks on that.
Well, I know, like, with rubella, for example, I think one of the big reasons that was pushed through was not so much to protect kids, but to protect pregnant women. So it seems like that would actually be, like a, for teachers, really. And so I wonder if some of this, like, if some of this is, when you talk about transmission from school, you're really talking about it affecting just the kids, I guess, as opposed to sort of, I mean, hopefully you don't have, like, transmission between administrators and students, but I think that may be part of it too.
Yeah, so that could be involved too. All right, others want to get into the pro mandate?
I think they talk about like hepatitis B and how there's a lot of questions about like whether or not having a mandate would increase high risk sexual practices. And
What does that mean?
Just because like children would think that now they're immune to cervical cancer, so they would be like think that now that's the reason for them to engage more.
Safer.
But I mean, it's kind of a flawed argument considering how many other STDs there are. So hopefully that would not happen. But I mean, I guess the comparison people make is to hepatitis B and the fact that there hasn't been an increase that they know of.
Was hepatitis B connected in its promotion to sexual transmission? Anybody know? It really wasn't. Even though it could have, they didn't. They sort of brought it forward as a disease preventer, but didn't really get in much to the transmission route. So why did HPV get connected to a sexual transmission route very quickly? Partly genital warts.
It's like a sexually related cancer. Yeah. It's a cancer of sexual organs.
But I could have run around and said I have an anti-cancer vaccine. I don't have to tell you too much about how you get it. It's an anti-cancer vaccine. I think it was because there was a campaign to put condoms into schools and prisons, and HPV vaccine didn't seem to be like prevented by condom use. Either it went through or, anyway, there was some doubt that you could prevent that by wearing a condom. And at least it was a doubt that some people who were anti-condom used a bit to promote or fight against condom distribution programs. And so HPV vaccine was made people on the pro-abstinence side nervous. And I think they actually made the link to sexual transmission as much as proponents of the vaccine did. So it was sort of in part of the abstinence wars. Because we're in high school, we're talking about not little kids now, but younger people. This whole topic got tied up in not only sexual safety, but also sexuality. And therefore, some people said you don't need a vaccine. What you need is to be abstinent. That's your best protection.
So then they're not real.
Well, speak for yourself.
I am. So I have two comments just in terms of, I think there are, I agree, more arguments against a mandate, but in terms of the mandate, I think that the strongest arguments are already made. I mean, one, I think, in my view, the strongest argument is the access argument, because to the extent that it's people in the communities that generally don't have the ability to pay for health care, they have the greatest need for this vaccine, are likely the people who won't go and get their pap smears on a regular basis to actually be able to prevent them from getting HPV through having mandates that then ensure coverage, to me that's one of the strongest arguments for a mandate. The other thing too, I think because of the political controversy and, you know, the parental concerns about, you know, do I really want to encourage my child for whatever, you know, all those arguments may be, the fact of the matter is, I mean, even if many people do survive having HPV having cervical cancer, who would want to, just kind of goes back to my own mentality about vaccines and the benefit of vaccines to persons. If you can prevent that disease, why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And since parents may feel uncomfortable making that decision in the absence of a mandate, perhaps we can save more young lives or prevent people from experiencing really devastating diseases because parents feel it's the right thing to do because it's a mandate, I have to do it anyway.
So that argument,
the decision making away from them.
Those sometimes choice isn't so constructive. The women that you're trying to protect can't choose for themselves, they have to rely on their parents. The parents might make bad choices because they're uncomfortable or not for the right reasons. And so it's better not to have to undergo a pap smear and a biopsy and surgery if you don't have to, so prevent it, something like
that. Well, who wants to go through that if you don't have
to? Exactly, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So even though, you can treat it with detecting it and then surgery, it's not anything that people would want to experience. So, and it's much easier to just prevent it. So, you know, don't rely on the choice here because you can't trust the parents to make reliable choices, particularly when we're in the tied up into the sexuality dispute.
Well, I just thought I could have one other comment related to that. I think physicians will be less likely to inject their own views on whether or not it's proper or improper for children to be vaccinated for this kind of with this kind of vaccine if there's a mandate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, just in my own experience, I've had, I have an 18-year-old son, so of course I work for the company that makes Gardasil, and I asked my son's physician whether he should have it. Well, shouldn't your son not be engaging in that activity? So it's just,
it's another layer of potential obstacle with people inserting their own value system again, in this case, the healthcare provider. By the way, why don't we vaccinate younger people? I mean, we're having this fight about vaccinating girls, you know, some age. We didn't say it's 13, 15, something.
We didn't do research on how long it lasts.
So that's the reason why. So you don't know if the vaccine has efficacy and potency for how many years. The original cohorts of women seem to still be getting an immune response at, I think it's now 12 years out, but if it makes it to 20, you could slide this down into the more pediatric vaccine schedule as opposed to where it is now. Why don't we vaccinate later? So there's a sexually active mm-hmm. question.
Do they look at the age at which most teens become sexually active to?
They did, and there are issues here too because the U.S. government doesn't like to fund studies of when people are sexually active for these political reasons we're talking about. So there are some studies, but it's not as well studied as you might think. There are also interesting opportunities for differences associated with economic, racial, and ethnic start of sexual activity. And there are certainly a few instances in which people are forced sexual activity upon them even as children. So all of that mixes into some. So the pediatricians, I think, I don't remember who it was, but the pediatrician said 15 and the gynecologist said 13 or vice versa. But there isn't, even on the standard side, there isn't really an agreement on what they recommend.
The back end was basically that if you look at HPV rates when it's in college, freshman versus the next year, by that time it's all over.
Uh-huh.
So the fact of the matter is that was the bracket on the top end, was that the acquisition rate.
You didn't hit it by the end of your
wall.
It was too late. You wanted to give it to me.
I just had a couple of, I'm for mandates, but only because it seems like there's no other option. One of the things is the younger the vaccine, the more the
maybe needed, not used yet.
But the other thing too is we seem somewhat shy about sharing the science with the public, the actual science. I mean, we talk about, you know, getting the Gardasil vaccine and we talk about statistics,
mm-hmm.
and we talk about, you know, how many women get infected with cervical cancer, how many women die. We talk about all that, but we don't seem to be willing to share the science. You know, in the beginning of our talk, we talked about HPV and the mode of epidemiology of it. What's wrong with sharing that information with the public?
You can clarify what you mean by science.
There seems like there's a trust issue. It's not just about the right to autonomy, but also the public doesn't trust the science. So is there a way to, yes, to share that kind of scientific information with the public so that...
I have some ideas about that, but I'm going to let that hang there for a while because others may have something to say about it, too. I mean, one primary conduit for sharing the science is the healthcare provider. But if they're nervous about, they have their own values to bring into the mix, they may not be sharing, they may be sharing normative views about what they want you to do or how they want you to parent or so forth. So that complicates it. Let's see who they have. Dave Hill back there.
Yeah. I guess first, just as far as like why not giving it younger, not even just the lasting efficacy, just the initial efficacy that I think in younger ages they were seeing that it didn't immunoconvert at all. So it was of no use to some of these patients. And also I seem to recall, and I'm not sure if I'm correct about this, that there had been a recommendation about sexual activity and receiving this vaccine, and that they have since dropped that? I seem to recall learning that at some point over the last couple years.
So they said before sexual activity, or?
Well, the recommendation was somehow tied to sexual activity.
The commencement of sexual
age,
activity. Yeah.
Of you receiving this vaccine. I also remember this in the context of the pap smear recommendations that they were all brought up at the same time to me, so.
You may be right. They may have decided to try and quiet some of the debate by simply saying our recommendation is that you get it starting at age 13 or starting at age 15 and tamp down the why that so
yeah.
kind of thing. That's possible. I just don't know I don't know.
So we talked about starting the vaccine earlier in the pediatric sense. What about, so the recommendation is until 26, right? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So 27-year-old, it's not recommended, or 28-year-old?
It was, again, are you likely to be infected with the strains? The vaccine is a blocking agent. It won't do you any good if you have it then.
So my question is, are you more likely to get HPV when you just becoming sexually active?
Yes.
So the first?
No, just earlier. You're more likely to pick up the virus, and it's related to partners and all that too, but the earlier you start, the more likely you are to, unless you're monogamous, to acquire.
If you're not monogamous at 26, 27, then...
Oh, no, it could be. I mean, there are certainly people who would say, it's just that the the number of non-monogamous 26-year-olds is somewhat less than the number of non-monogamous 13-year-olds. I think I said that right. Anyway, so yeah, they're just less action at 13. Less at 13. Starts picking up about then. And then... If you've been monogamous at 26, you certainly could consider the vaccine, but there were relatively fewer monogamous women at 26, so they didn't have that in the mandate side. It wasn't that you couldn't have it, or it might not be right for you. It probably drops into the you should discuss this with your doctor category, that kind of thing. It's not that it's not something you wouldn't get, you just have to say, you know, I think.
I have a friend who's, she was turning 30, and she went to her doctor, and she said, can I still get this?
Uh-huh.
And she says, I'll give it to you, but I didn't understand that because she's 30. So maybe that is a talk to your doctor.
Yeah.
But I think your insurance companies won't pay for it if you're over 26.
Okay.
And so that opens the door to one other question. What else is involved in a mandate?
So if you mandate it, then it'll be covered. So that's the other part of the universal access.
So in the U.S. vaccine policy world, there are two kinds of mandates, aside from the level at which you allow exemptions. One mandate comes from what a group decides, say a state legislature or something, they're going to require that you do to get into school or get some benefit. So there are states, Virginia's one, that has a mandate. I think Washington, D.C. still has its mandate. You're supposed to get this vaccine, and the health department's supposed to show up and give it to you, and I guess you can opt out of it, but your presumption is you're going to get it. But there's also this committee, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which advises CDC. It's a science committee, and it advises the Centers for Disease Control, and they meet periodically and literally consider whether new vaccines are going to be recommended. The language that's used there is, we're going to recommend this vaccine, meaning we think that it would be wise to add it to the schedule of required vaccinations. Language is used to describe that as mandate. It means that most insurers are going to start to cover it. And so we have this weird dual concept, mandate meaning a state legislator, a medical group like the American Pediatrics Association, they recommend it. Okay, that's a kind of a mandate in a way. But it's also the ACIP decision as to whether or not this thing is deemed not just safe, not just effective, but worthwhile enough to put it on the schedule. And that's described as mandating it, and that's a way you trigger coverage. So both things are in play around mandates. And I didn't clarify that when I asked you the question kind of deliberately, but sometimes you want to see a vaccine mandated in the sense in which the ACIP recommends it, and this comes up with the boys issue, which we'll get to in a little bit, because that means someone's going to pay for it, or they'll dip into the Vaccines for Children's Fund to pay for it. It triggers reimbursements. It has nothing to do with, can I opt out, can I opt in? It's just on the schedule, and people say, oh, well, it's on the schedule, I guess we're stuck having to pay for it. In the new world of Obama land and health reform, they're putting an emphasis on prevention. It's not clear that this old system of ACIP recommendation is going to be as necessary to trigger coverage, because they're supposed to start paying, if you looked at the PPACA Act, that it's going to be more reimbursement. So, my sister's gone, I mean, my God, the entire clan. So you have perhaps a change coming. I'm just flagging this. I don't know how this is going to play out. The old way of doing it, including what happened with HPV, was people wanted it mandated, meaning please put it on the schedule, people will pay for it. Not that a state would say you can't go to school with that. So that's the second sense. Both into play, maybe under health reform, with more money moving to just pay for routine preventive things. You don't have to get it on the schedule. It's just, they'll pay for all vaccines. Who knows? I don't know.
Another question that I think is important is, federal budget, we all know, is not infinite budget.
Mm-hmm.
It's limited. And my question is HPV at the top priority to fund? If we are talking,
so you're betraying your gender because you're now, of course, on the negative side of this mandate, but that's all right. Go on. Sell them out. See if I do. So,
but
where is it?
If you're considering universal access and fairness, and the fact that HPV is more common in poor communities.
So let me set this up. I'm not going to answer it right now, but I want to set it up as a interesting policy question about vaccination. Hillary says, I just want to know if a vaccine works. I want to know if it prevents rotten disease. Mm-hmm. And if there's evidence for that, then put it out there. Hila says, well, wait a minute. We can't just necessarily pay for every vaccine that works because we have to make choices. It's a limited budget. Cervical cancer isn't the biggest plague in the United States. Maybe there's other things we should vaccinate for or spend it on something else. So I'm not so sure just because it works, we ought to worry about it too much. This issue comes up a lot in vaccine policy, both in the U.S. but also worldwide. Let me give you an example. Bill Gates says, I want to throw another couple of $1 billion into polio eradication. Somebody might say, that's nice, and I'm sure that'll work, or we have a shot at it anyway, but that same amount of money could buy X number of other lives, so I'm not sure that's the best expense. Most data reported in the literature on vaccines when it's in developing countries does not compare the vaccines. It doesn't say rabies is better than dengue fever if we had it, or then trying to get after the measles. It just says, this vaccine is effective, this vaccine is safe, go pay for it. You know, go get it. Here's one that works. It doesn't ask the comparative question. If you have a finite budget, then you ought to give the top three funding and distribution priorities to these vaccines. There's relatively little comparative data on the international scene. It's more your question of if it works, then let's get it out there. Better to prevent diseases than to have them happen, even if they're low incidence or it's not the biggest problem or the biggest headache in this particular country. Prevention is just worth something inherently. I mean, better that than trying to let these diseases proliferate. And when you got one that prevents, even if you have other things like you dream about clean water or you want a road or you think it would be great to have something that would help against infant diarrhea because that would just be a bigger footprint, that isn't the argument. So the tension is there. If it works in the rich countries, then why is it on the damn list? We don't really have to make those kind of choices. We're not really squaring off HPV against, you know, some other vaccine preventable thing. And in the international setting, if it works, then why aren't they doing it? Because prevention is just a boom. And I don't want to hear that you can't buy them all. Now, maybe you can't buy them all, but that's not the sales stop. Everybody follow that? So there's a sort of, what's my ethical obligation to compare them and say, relatively speaking, here's the top five problems, rotavirus, top of my list, that's going to get the biggest bang for the buck. I don't care about HPV, I don't care about some other minor thing, and we're going to put our focus over here versus anytime I can show you that a vaccine is effective, your government ought to get in there and do something about it, because preventing that is just good.
But ethically, can you really compare unless you have true comparative data? I mean, like, how can you go there and make those kinds of choices?
Well what I'm saying is the international debate, they don't want to go there.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. But they
don't collect that data.
Can you do it? I mean, so if you can't.
Could they do it? I think they could do better. I don't know if they could do it perfectly. They could do it a little better. But they don't. They tend to just say, here's the data, this works. Okay? Do something. I mean, that tends to be the Gates Foundation style of presentation. If this works, go get them. It's not, this works better than that, or, you know, let's all have sanitation tomorrow and forget the stupid vaccines or whatever. You know, it's not that way. It's sort of like, this works, here we go.
Well, this really illustrates that if we mandate what needs to go hand in hand, the much bigger and honest public discussion about what HPV is, and I think especially with kids, you know, the saying like, it's not going to make you invincible, it's not a cure-all, you know, again, this is either bivalent or quadrivalent. There are still other strains that could give you cancer, that could give you general warts or any other disease, and it was the call for reading that said perhaps a vaccine is going to undermine preventative messages, but I think, I mean, just the rates of teenage pregnancy, was 7% of women, girls between 15 and 19 were pregnant in 2006, which demonstrates that, I mean, kids are sexually active and there needs to be a better discussion about it. And I think, you know, especially with regards to HPV transmission, it's seems like it's still unclear exactly all the ways that it's transmitted, and kids need to be aware that it's not just black and white, condom, no condom, that you could still get HPV even using the condom, which was backed up by the reading.
Yeah, somewhere. Which is how, that's again, part of the reason this got tied into the whole abstinence, sexual virtue kind of discussion.
Yeah, so.
You know, one other thing to say, you know, Goody, and then I'm going to go a little bit of comment to other men or women who have objections to the mandate, what they might want to add in here. But one thing I find interesting is that if you're more on the liberal end, this discussion makes you seem a little fuddy-duddy or prudish if you want to break into a discussion about sexual behavior and ethics. And I don't think that's off the table at all. I mean, I think that's a perfectly fine subject. You could certainly try to talk to young people and say, you know, you want to protect yourself against sexually transmitted diseases, or it's emotionally difficult to be in sexual relationships or have children and raise them alone and all the rest of it, I have no issue personally holding off on, you know, what's virtuous or good conduct about sex. The problem is whether it gets heard. I mean, it's, I don't have any problem talking about it. And I think sometimes some progressives and liberals, as opposed to conservatives, have more heartburn about trying to even be judgmental about it. I don't think there's anything judgmental about trying to talk to a 12-year-old about their sex life. I'm happy to see it done by parents. I'm making this argument, or schools, whoever wants to, or television shows that are on there. Are exactly pro-chastity things. But I mean, it's fine to have that discussion. I'm not sure it's fine to have just that discussion. That is, the abstinence-only discussion strikes me as a little false. But it certainly can be part of discussion of things. There's nothing, you know, asking kids to think about what kind of life they want to lead or what kind of values they want to bring to sexuality seems to me to be part of adulthood and growing up. And that, there's nothing wrong with any of that, to bring it up when you don't have to be prudish about it. The question, you know, the data just don't bear out the idea that it's a hell of a lot effective in sort of reducing unwanted pregnancies and so on. So I think you got to be ready for that world too. What you call naive earlier is, I don't know, it's hopeful, but it's hopeful. It's not necessarily something that you could you want to bank all your public health policy on. All right, problems with mandates? Anything else that anybody thought of at all that come up? Ian,
well,
I'm sorry.
I was bothered by, I also support a mandate, and I think it's because of the justice and access component that would make me say, if we can afford it, if we over time find it safe, then we should share it and make sure that people have access to it, certainly here in the U.S. for sure. I think the two things that bothered me about this, there was something about this herd concept, because you know, the utilitarian argument that if you were going to get this herd benefit made me feel like it needed to be mandated, it needed to be both male and female. We just ought to go after it. We ought to have a very clear policy about what we're trying to do, why we're trying to do it, then go after it so that we got the benefit of time. Because you didn't have the utilitarian argument if it did not actually show you were going to achieve it. And I felt that the question that was really left out of all the reading was, is that a realistic outcome? Can we expect to really have it? You know, I would think that in a shortened amount of time we'd have a better shot than the idea that it might mutate and change, as you brought up. You know, so to me that was a policy issue, and I felt like that one should be addressed. I found, there's something I just don't quite understand it, but I was a little bit bothered. This is going to be really funny for me. I think I was a little bit bothered there were two products. And I couldn't see that they were two products or they were equivalent products. Mm-hmm. And it bothered me that we don't really know. We know one might do more than the other. Am I ever really going to know 10 years from now which one I got? And if we find out that there was something from one, do you think I'm going to remember? Mm. I mean, I had all kinds of vaccines, but I also had measles and chickenpox and mumps and all those things. And so from my perspective, are you going to know which one you got? And so I really got very disturbed when I started thinking of the direct-to-consumer advertising and that we might try to push one brand or the other. And do people really know enough to make a decision? And is it going to be a low-cost thing? And are you going to ask anybody which one did I get?
I think their doctor's likely to make that call.
Right. So I don't know.
Or their public health program, whichever buys, you know, whoever buys the vaccine.
Right. Well,
I mean, I don't think too many people run into the office and say, give me that Merck stuff.
No, I'm sure they don't. I'm sure they get, do you want the vaccine? Yes,
correct.
I do.
Right.
And someone later says to you, well, you know, were you protected from genital warts?
Yeah.
Well, I don't guess I'm going to know.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I don't know. I found that.
Or the health department of Philadelphia buys the cheaper Glaxo one and just uses it. That's, you know, there isn't even a, it just sort of happens that way. So that's interesting. I haven't thought about that. I think that's an interesting point as to whether you would, do you need them? If you do have them, is it creating problems to have the competition, if you will? Other issues?
I think we've sort of short-sold the cost issue because it does seem to me, I mean, at the end of the day, despite my assignment here, I still come down in favor of some sort of promotion, although mandate whatever that means, mm-hmm. probably is not the best idea tactically, I think. But I think that if we're dealing with a vaccine that prevents between 60% and 70% of the incidence of cancer, we're not going to do away with the system of screening that we now have. So, in fact, the savings on that are ephemeral, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in this time when particularly Medicaid programs are severely stressed, adding what is going to be a significant cost for a mandate, because, by the way, I think if not legally, certainly politically, if you're going to mandate it for school entrance, it's going to have to be both sexes. So the cost is going to be that much more. I don't know, maybe.
You know,
if it's going to be a real mandate, not a mm-hmm. super soft mandate, but if it was a real mandate, I think at the very least as a political matter, it's going to be really tough to do it one sex only. So you're talking about a significant cost now to programs that are highly stressed,
mm-hmm.
and you're not buying back any of that cost by reductions in the screening system. So the question is, if you put some of those resources, but not all of them, into the screening system, do you end up getting the same effect? And somebody earlier said that it was a lot more likely that the mandate would, in fact, drive people towards medical care who are now not participating in the system. I think you can make the argument the opposite way as well, that if the emphasis is on screening, you're more likely to drive people towards primary care that aren't now affiliated with primary care than you are by simply giving them a shot. So,
shot's probably going to take place. It could take place outside the primary care world, actually. I mean, they might come to school
right.
to do it.
Right. Right.
So and that's
if, but
possible.
Right. If you're really promoting screening in a serious way,
yeah, yeah.
you're getting people
different.
At the physician's office.
Different attitude.
So, I mean, I think that's a more serious con argument
mm-hmm.
than we have so far given it credit for.
Although, I'm sorry, to address that, I mean, we were talking, it's $4.6 billion in follow-up, not to the PAP program, but to the follow-up to the PAP smear program.
Yeah,
so.
But you're not going to save that money, because if 30% of the cancers are still out there, everybody vaccinated or not still has to get screened.
Right, but I think that $4.6 billion is how much is spent after the screening program.
If you save it down the pipeline,
right.
But that's speculative.
All the rest of the interventions, too.
Right. But that we don't have data on that.
No, I think that's roughly half the surgical and
so forth,
and the Pap smear is about half of that. It's probably a split on that $4.6 billion. But it saves something, a little bit, but it's not the hugest return in the world.
And one of the things I've been thinking about is that part of the reason we have such a lower incidence of cervical cancer in the States is because of screening programs. And so those 3,000 cases of women who are getting cervical cancer every year are likely women who are not as adherent to the screening protocols. So
I can intervene and say, where are they?
Right.
Straight on that Appalachia through Texas, that little crescent of underserved people. That's where they are.
Right, or, you know, like West Philadelphia.
Yeah,
I mean, like
exactly.
People
with a few pockets.
Who are just aren't coming in for
yeah.
their screening. So
mm-hmm.
those are people that we're already not spending money on to screen. So I don't really know what that means. I mean, to me, that is a strong argument in favor of access, because those are the people that the vaccine is going to help the most. Mm-hmm. Because the people who would have access to the vaccine otherwise are also more likely to be people who are going to be.
So, I mean, you could argue push the vaccine into the belt of cervical cancer and concentrate there,
right.
Put your mandates there, do whatever it takes there. Maybe that's a compromise
yeah.
if you're trying to really get a better yield for your investment.
Yeah, I don't view the HPV vaccine as pushing people into primary care. I agree that pushing screening would do that. But screening is every single year you're going in and getting a Pap smear.
Mm-hmm.
HPV vaccine is, three shots when you're a kid and then
mm-hmm.
it's over. And while, yes, it'd be great to focus more on screening, I agree, I don't think money would necessarily make those people get screened.
So just a little factual description that we got for you to tell us about boys. You're still with us here, right? So,
yeah.
So what's the uptake of HPV vaccine right now in the U.S.? Anybody know? Probably about 10% of women have had it. They're definitely upper class. They definitely are the lowest risk people for getting cervical cancer. Boys are infinitesimally tiny percentage of people who've had it. I wouldn't say Merck got the reward it expected from the vaccine, but it wasn't horrible. I mean, it's been okay. Didn't get where they hoped. Overseas, in the developing world, the profile isn't all that much different. In a lot of countries, I think it's relatively higher in the UK. I mean, like 50%. I think Australia is hovering around 10% of people vaccinated. And then places where cervical cancer is really killing women at high rates, it's not there. So it's been, so far, an upper class, rich person vaccine. That's where it's gone, as its footprint pretty much in the world. I think Merck has recouped its investment. It's not that. Glaxo, we'll see. And there is an interesting issue about, which we, you know, I mentioned it, we're going to come back to it again. If you make the quadrivalent vaccine and it doesn't get bought at the rate you expected, how hard are you going to push to get the non-valent vaccine, that is the 9-valent vaccine? Now, there is some work going on, I happen to know, at Merck to get that, but how enthusiastically, or whether the project would be shut down, or I don't know. I mean, if you don't get a lot of sale off the 2 or the 4, your incentive to run back and build the better vaccine may diminish, or maybe that was the money you were going to use to do it, or whatever. So,
but isn't that the argument for a really clear policy on what you're trying to do with it?
Could be. Yeah. I mean, we're going to think about that with HIV vaccine and dreams of malaria vaccine. Coming up with the 100% effective HIV vaccine seems to me to be really unlikely. But if you got to the 30% effective HIV vaccine, you're going to roll it out and just say, you know, we got this, and we're going to save a lot of lives, and it's good enough, and we're never going to get to the other one, never, and see you later. I don't know. But that's a really tough trade-off question about when is a vaccine. I mean, remember, our friends at the ACIP, our recommenders, do not say effective enough. They just say effective. And safe, and that's it. And pretty much the FDA approval process, by the way, on drugs looks much the same way. It doesn't say, comparator-wise, you better be at 80% for us to approve this relative to whatever existing thing is. It just says, oh, your sleeping pill, yeah, that works too. And it's good enough to put out there with the other 59 of them and have at it, you know, compete. But it doesn't say, you better get a response out of more than 50% of the people who take it, or you better be better than the 10 approved drugs. It's just kind of, it's safe and effective. That's what we've been charged to do. We have a system that, in a way, uses the marketplace to sort out the answer to the question, how effective should this be? So I'm not going to say that's a horrible answer. It's just that is prescriptively what the answer is right now. All right. So boys to men.
Right. Just as a parting shot on the demographics of the, you know, HPV vaccine uptake, it seems to me that it would seem a little bit more, you know, against the hoi polloi if we were to mandate only poor people have to take the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a parting shot. So as I frame the, you know, should boys get it or not, I, you know, frame that in the larger context of mandate, because it makes sense for boys to be vaccinated if there's a complete hard mandate for everybody to get vaccinated. That's why you have herd immunity. Even if there's like a little bit of chink in the armor, then the boys who, you know, don't really have the risks that women do upon this disease exposure, they have all the risk. You know, something that we were talking about last week, they have to withstand the risk, whatever that is. It may not be important, but there's some risk that they have to withstand that to not get any benefit, or not provide any benefit to both men and women. So that's just one thing. I mean, in various other flavors, the other arguments against, you know, vaccinating women also apply to boys, like utility, like, you know, cost-benefit analysis. But I thought that was something uniquely important to the, should we recommend vaccination for boys.
So they're getting protection against genital warts too. really don't get cervical cancer, but
right.
do get a little bit of protection against some other kinds of cancers, at least the most recent data shows. But you want to say primarily the reason to vaccinate is to build more herd immunity to protect women more than benefits
right,
to
because,
males.
Well, especially if you're talking about the cancer thing. Genital warts, well, we run into, once again, the problem of qualities, you know,
mm-hmm.
as you alluded to.
Okay.
Well, I think the question was, should not mandate for boys,
mm-hmm.
but recommend.
Encourage, promote.
Encourage. I mean, I think the arguments against encouragement are pretty slim. I think there is a, I mean, the same cost argument adheres. I mean, that's unavoidable. But in term, I mean, I think encouragement probably is the way to go for both sexes.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody see any numbers on what it would take to achieve maximum herd immunity of female, male, you know?
It was like 70-80%. I saw a number like that.
Yeah, there is a number around, which
yeah,
I expected both of you to tell me. but I think it's something like if you vaccinated, I'm guessing a little bit, but I don't think I'm far off, 60% of women and 20% of men, you'd get a pretty good footprint, the same as if you got to 90% of women. Now remember, we're at 10% of women, so we ain't at big threats of achieving anything right now. But there is a number at which you don't have to do more than encourage men, because you could, if you were pretty good at promoting it to women, even encouraging it, you might get the same herd immunity benefit that you got if you really tried to promote it equally to men and women, plus they get the cervical cancer benefit is what I'm getting at, so.
Yeah, I looked at that, there's a citation one of these for some CDC PowerPoint I looked up,
mm-hmm.
and it was like evaluating the quality adjusted life years if you give it to women and men, the percentages
mm-hmm.
and whatever, and the men, like, no matter how much you gave to, regardless of how much the women had, the men was always a much higher quality adjusted life year, even if you took into account penile cancer, oral cancer,
general. The cost
cancer.
Of hitting them was just...
Yeah, it just wasn't worth it in terms of, it was much more effective to run after the women, to run after the older women,
mm-hmm.
Pretty much do everything but go after the males,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which I think was something that did factor heavily into the decision
mm-hmm.
not to recommend it for males.
So that bang for the buck argument could still be around, just in terms of you have a limited budget to, if you just try to encourage, forget about mandate, just, you know, put up posters or train doctors to ask or have a little more direct-to-consumer push or whatever you want to do. Still may not make the most sense from a herd immunity point of view to chase the males usually, or it's not that it's a discourage them, but it's, the focus looks stronger on the women than the men, I think, in terms of what you get yield-wise for trying. Is there any other disease prevention thing that we forgot to mention here that goes with HPV vaccine besides?
There's a baby disease.
Yeah, so there's this.
Laryngeal papillomatosis.
You can get the papillomavirus in the lungs of the baby, and it can be bad. And there are probably about, I don't know, 300 or 400 of those a year. And that is another preventive effect that you get by pushing it to women as opposed to men. It's not huge, but I noticed, and you can go back and check, not every cost-benefit analysis, A, paid attention to the RPP, the baby cases, didn't include it always. Some were a little fuzzy on the general wart side of the street, and most of them didn't say much about non-cervical cancers. Now that could be because some of these analyses were done earlier and they didn't have much on the penile and the anal and genital and all the rest of that stuff. But it is interesting, I mean, it's trite to remind you of this, but remember, your cost-benefit analysis also makes assumptions and what you measure, what you're looking at, and to some extent, you want to be at least reading carefully to see, did they really get all the diseases in there? What did they presume about the quality of life adjustment that, you know, general warts in this case might or might not bring to bear? There are obviously other assumptions in there that they're leaning on about age of sexual activity, onset, if you will, which they draw from other places. So a cost-benefit analysis, despite its numbers, is a pretty leveraged up entity with a lot of assumptions that you want to look at somewhat critically. I mean, just sort of asking yourself, well, what are they presuming as I read this in terms of the cost-benefit work? Now, that's a standard problem with any utilitarian or consequentialist analysis. It sort of rides on what you think is the benefit that you're trying to measure. How measurable is the benefit? What I was pushing at a little bit in this Hela versus Hillary debate was, there are certain people who might say, you know, if it's babies and it prevents, I don't really need a cost-benefit analysis. I think there has to be a commitment in a rich country to give it to them, to an ontological principle. Babies get vaccinated, get prevented, I don't need numbers. That's it, I don't care. Could be 10 times the value of doing something else, I don't care. Babies get it, that's just how it is, and that's gonna drive my policy. When Sarah Palin or other critics of some of the end of life care stuff yell about, you know, don't withhold it, they're making a version of that argument. They're sort of saying, I don't care what it costs to keep grandma going, even in a dilapidated or impaired state. Older people deserve the right to go on, even if it's in a very impaired. Now, you don't have to buy that. I'm just trying to point out to you that it's a value system that's saying there is a right to access to certain types of things. And I think in the vaccine area, this little discussion was a sort of a break point between some people who might take a, in principle, access when it's a child or a fetus, versus I want to see the utilitarianism, I'm going to compute them all, put them together and weigh the relative benefit. Not every vaccine policy thing is a cost-benefit thing. Even if it is, you can sort of critique the assumptions and sort of see, do you agree with the way it's analyzed? But even if you don't like that, you might just say, to hell with this. I don't want anybody getting cervical cancer, 2,500 cases and a lot of operations, country's rich, figure it out, give it to them. I don't care if it's not worth, you know, if it's costing me $200,000 per life saved or something. You have to do it in some obligation sense of being able to prevent it. Everybody get that pull of it? It's the non-utilitarian. So when we use cost-benefit analysis in public policy, what have we done? We've made an ethical assumption about what's the best way to approach the resolution of public policy issues. It's consequential. Not everybody buys into that. I mean, you can see, I'm not trying to carry water here for Sarah Palin or her analysis, but I get, even though I don't personally agree with it, I understand exactly where it's coming from. It's coming from an, in principle, you must give the elderly who are dying full resources. And that may gall everybody who's looking at the budget saying, you're gonna really give grandma with dementia tons of resources when you wouldn't give Joe with a heart condition, you know, statins or something. Well, yeah, kinda. I mean, that's sort of where the position is. And you almost have to be ready to meet it and say, I don't think that's what grandma would want, or I'm not sure that's the best policy for babies. It still may not make sense if you care about babies to just go blindly to, if it works, give it to them. But you're up against a strong moral division, and there's a strong moral presumption in public policy that's being carried blindly, which is that consequentialist analysis is the way we ought to think through vaccine public policy when you're doing cost-benefit or quality style or cost-effectiveness work. It just is. Those are just fancy versions in the 21st century of John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham. They're just computed, and a few other economic hangers-on. So they're just much more sophisticated, but they are still consequentialist arguments. Everybody follow that? So it really is a deep, deep, deep division within vaccine policy. All right, so next week, we're going to lead in. We have 2 weeks coming of the this is our Jenny McCarthy, Oprah. I saw on Oprah, by the way, I think it's tomorrow or the next day. I have to watch with this, Hila. Daytime formats. Dr. Oz is entertaining Dr. Sears, who will tell us about staggering out our vaccine schedule, not too much immune challenge at any one point, which, I don't know, science here doesn't seem to bear that one out. He's not anti-vaccination, but he wants you to get them across a lifespan or something. So it's and there are some other anti-vaccine voices that will be on Dr. Oz tomorrow or the next day. I'll keep an eye out for it, and I'll send it to you. But what we're really going to talk about is safety concerns and how the worries in particular about autism got going. So here's your assignment, and you can take this one in any direction you want. I'm going to come next week as a parent, and I want to know, what should I do about vaccination from you? I have a child. I'm not going to tell you much about this child other than it's a little child, a relatively young child. The child may show signs of certain things. I will perhaps vary those variables depending on which of you is going to talk to me. But I'm going to ask you to tell me a little bit about, what should I think about? How should I make a decision? What are my options? What are my rights? What I saw, I may ask you what I saw on the internet about this stuff, or what my neighbor told me, or whatever. I mean, so I'm going to put you in the advisor role. You be the doctor, you be the nurse. I don't know, you can be Dr. Oz. Anybody like with a medical health kind of perspective. But I want you to be ready to answer my queries about whether I should get my child vaccinated. And when I say vaccinated, I mean that in the open-ended sense, like, you know, vaccinated. I don't know, what are there? 211 shots he's supposed to get before he's 2 weeks old or something? That's what I heard. I mean, might as well attach him to a gigantic needle machine and you just stab him for some long interlude. So I'm just worried about vaccination. I know it's going to come up, and I just need some advice from somebody. So read your readings that way. The week after that, when Offit comes, you're going to get a very strong, you know, vaccines are good, and anybody who doubts their safety and efficacy is bonkers kind of look. And next week, I'm okay if we sort of think about, well, what are the safety issues? What are the risk issues? I'm not trying to be an Offit here and sell you on the glories of vaccination. I'm just trying to get you to look at the literature that's out there in an honest way. You may want to take a little Google tour to see what I might have read about vaccines before you come, because I know there are a lot of authorities out there who say, be careful about this vaccine stuff. So it will take you about 12 seconds to find a very rich mine of information that is out there about vaccines and vaccine safety and whether I need to get them or I can just live in the fresh air of Utah and maintain my health pretty well if I just want to make a move. It's certainly not the fresh air of Philadelphia, but you know, Utah, someplace in the mountains somewhere I can join a polygamous cult. Anyway, all right, so that's the assignment for next week. And look closely at the readings. If you do that, you'll also be in a better position to go with the Offit presentation. You'll find Offit fun, and he likes to debate and talk, so there's no problem with that. All right, I need to talk to you one second. You're out of here.